A book of poems begins with a woman from Kansas City, a Native American woman thinking about two places at once, the West Bottoms and Syria. She's been wondering about the meatpacking plant where her father worked before it was razed to the ground and the community around it vanished. She's also been remembering the Syrian towns she visited in the 1990s. They've all gone dark in recent years as buildings crumble and the lights in once vibrant cities keep going out. It's a ridiculous comparison, she writes, but comparisons are what poetry is made of. And a lot of Native American poets have visited the Middle East and written about their journeys. Is there something to that? I'm Gina Kaufman. Let's talk with an editor of the new anthology that gathers those poems in one place. Linda Rodriguez, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Well, thank you for having me, Gina.
Tell me the story of this book. Where did the idea come from?
Well, I knew a lot of my friends who were also Native American writers had visited the Middle East and written about it. And then Joy Harjo, there was a huge kind of mini storm in academia when she agreed to go to Israel and fulfill a contract to speak there. And there's this big academic boycott, cultural boycott of Israel. And I was
meaning that you that within academic circles you're not supposed to go and speak in Israel.
Yes, yes, they're supposed to boycott them because of their treatment of the Palestinians. And Joy is not in favor of their treatment of the Palestinians and also saw Palestinians while over there. But she felt that cutting them off completely is not a way to create dialogue and make change. And so she went anyway. And I'm a friend of Joy's, and I was watching from the sidelines, and I watched all the abuse she got. Then my friend Diane Glancy, who also lives here in Kansas City.
Your co-editor.
Yes. Wrote a group of poems about her time in Syria. You know, she was very concerned as the news has been full of all the destruction in Syria. And
she's the woman whose story I was kind of hinting at the beginning there, who made that West Bottom Syria comparison and then felt apologetic and maybe silly about it.
And yet it's not at all silly. There's a very moving part of her introductory essay in which she talks about the killing lanes in the slaughterhouses down in the West Bottoms back when she was a child and her father worked there.
The killing lanes meaning what?
That they drive the cattle through in to be slaughtered. And how it resonated with some of the stuff she was seeing on television about the destruction in Syria. And she's very...
Just like a sense of inevitability, maybe?
Yeah, like a sense of inevitability and like a sense of all these people have been objectified and are just being driven into their deaths. And people are killing them with no more thought than her father and the other employees killed cattle for our steaks and hamburgers.
So you're observing Diane's poetry from her visits to Syria and Jordan emerging. You're also watching your friend Joy making this endeavor to go speak in Israel despite of all of academia objecting to that. And what are your thoughts?
Well, I'm talking to my husband about it. My husband is the managing editor of Bookmark Press here at UMKC. And he has published Diane before in the past, and he was very interested in this. And he said, "I bet I could get an NEA grant to do a book about this." And he talked with Diane, and she agreed, though she thought he was kind of crazy. "We'll never be able to get enough writers, you know. It'll be such a terrible undertaking." And so, out of these, you know, these various ideas coming from three different places. Ben did get the NEA grant, and we did put together the book. It took us several years because hurting writers is like hurting cats, and hurting Native writers is like hurting feral cats, you know. And
tell me about your background. You're a contributor to this book.
Yes. I'm kind of a mongrel. I'm part Cherokee. I'm part Irish and Scots. My first husband for 18 years was first generation Chicano, and I lived for 40 years, you know, for a long, long time. I've lived in that community and been fortunate enough to be accepted by that community. So culturally, I'm kind of with a foot in all these different communities. And I, you know, I'm a poet and a novelist. And so it was kind of a natural for me to be doing this.
Do you think that there is some larger sense of kinship between Indigenous people here on this continent and Indigenous people in the Middle East? Is that what resonates to you throughout all these works that you've collected in this anthology?
Oh, I think anyone reading the book would see that. There's a lot. Leanne Howe, who's a marvelous Choctaw writer, writes about going to Jordan and being in this small town in Jordan and how it just reminds her so much of her hometown in Oklahoma. And Trevino Brings Plenty, who is a Lakota poet, was over there meeting a Bedouin, and the Bedouin is asking him, "Who are you? What are you?" And he's trying to explain to this Bedouin, who can't understand this concept of American but not really American because they don't really accept us. And finally he looks, compares their skin, and he says, "I know you, you're a Bedouin." And Trevino says, Yeah, because his people are very much, they were very much like the Bedouins. You know, they were a horse people. They were a nomadic people.
Is there a danger in, I mean, there's something beautiful about seeing your own experience in someone else's experience, especially when there are a lot of really like objective similarities. But then is there also a danger in it in saying, "I am you, you are me"?
You know, I don't think anyone is saying, "I am you, you are me." But there are just, you know, there are so many parallels. For example, natives in this country, we really resonate with what has been going on in the last half of the 20th century in the Middle East. We know what it's like to have these Europeans come in, take your land, take your resources, move you from one place to another, set up artificial rulers over you that aren't necessarily your rulers, try to change your whole culture and structure. We know what that's like.
There's also, I mean, something that I've heard from a lot of people is that that there's a way in our culture that we can talk about Native Americans and Native American history as though it doesn't continue to live, you
yes.
know? And that I wonder if there is also a similarity there in maybe how we talk about certain communities in the Middle East.
I think a lot of average Americans tend to think of Native Americans as the lone warrior with the headdress on the horse riding off into the sunset. And natives are part of, you know, the vast majority of natives live in urban areas. We're not all on the reservations. You know, 75% of us are in urban areas. And I think it's the same with the Middle East. We like to think of the sort of
the
Lawrence of Arabia Bedouins and all. And they're living in rural, in urban areas. They're living in the contemporary world. They like rap music.
This is kind of a big question, but do you think that poetry is political, or do you think it transcends the political? I mean, a book like this, do you think that you are making a political statement, or do you think that you are stepping away from politics?
Now, we didn't do this book to make a political statement, but I think poetry at its best, as in any writing at its best, if it's true to human, you know, to human experience, it's going to be political because human experience is political.
You know, you mentioned a couple of stories from the book. Are there a couple others that you'd like to draw our attention to, people whose journeys really surprised you in some way?
Well, Linda Hogan, who's a wonderful fiction writer and poet, went to a small town as part of her tour in the Middle East. And she was very tired, and it was late at night, and they pulled her out into the setting, and all of a sudden all of these old men with beards and dressed in these white gowns came out, and they danced and they did this whirling dance that just almost took her out of herself. And she writes a wonderful poem about this, you know, that it was kind of this transcendent experience.
Your co-editor writes that we can occupy two places at once through poetry. And that is really the idea of poetry, is unexpected images kind of side by side, paired in ways you wouldn't imagine and giving you some kind of new thought. But the idea of occupation in this context is pretty loaded.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Occupation is something natives are very, very used to. And it's something that Middle Eastern people are living with. And occupation is just fraught. It's fraught with all these bombs, you know. I think a lot of people, if they are aware of natives in the present day, they think of us as always angry, because we keep pointing to some of these things. We keep saying, you know, this country is built on genocide. This country is built on the theft of land and the killing of millions of people and ethnic cleansing. And that's just a fact, you know. It's sometimes we're angry, like with Standing Rock. Yeah, we can get pretty angry because it's you all are saying, oh, but that's way in the past. But it's still continuing now. Environmental racism is something natives in this country are very familiar with because it's still going on today. Most of the resource extraction in this country takes place around native lands and destroys their environment and their water and everything.
Do you find some kind of, I don't know, freedom in the idea of occupation through language as opposed to the very fraught kind of occupation of land?
Yeah, because I think there's a positive way to occupy. If we're occupying two spaces, if we're, you know, one of the problems, I think, with mainstream America is we're very binary. You know, it's either this or it's that. It's all these dichotomies. Well, natives in this country, we're used to having to live with contradictions. We're used to having to say, I'm an American citizen and I love my country and I'm proud of my country and I fight for my country. We fight in greater numbers with greater heroism than any other population group. And at the same time, my country has really messed me over, has messed my people over. You know, these are two very contradictory things we have to hold at the same time. And we have there's a lot of other things. We try to hold on to our traditional teachings, where this is something else we have in common with Middle Eastern people, where elders are held in high regard in most Native communities, especially the grandmothers, the clan mothers, these women, everybody listens to them. They have a lot of clout. Native tribes mostly were matrilineal, and if the women didn't have ultimate power, they had equal power. And that's been changed in all these years as we've lived in patriarchal the United States as it's become that. But it's never gone completely away. So we can hold that together with the modern American world we live in. So we're experts at this, holding contradictory ideas together. And it's something I think that perhaps mainstream America could learn from us and make it a little easier to deal with all the dichotomies that are out there dividing this nation right now.
I'd like to bring Kim Shuck in on this conversation. She's one of the poets who contributed to this book, The World is One Place, Native Americans Visit the Middle East. She's also the poet laureate of San Francisco. Hi, Kim.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Tell me about yourself and your background.
I'm, through my father, I'm a citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. Through my mother, I'm Polish-American, of, I don't know, I guess I want to say of Union family in San Francisco. And I've been writing so long I don't remember when I started.
What drew you to the Middle East?
Okay, so my father is I know this word is overused, but he really is. He's an electronics genius, and he was paid to go around the planet during the 70s, putting in satellite ground stations. And one of the places that he spent some time was in the Arab region, the Middle East. So It was a time when we had started being told all kinds of things about, quotes, those people. And I think with Dad's travel, one of the things I noticed is that there are rarely those people.
There's anywhere.
That guy. Anywhere. That guy, those guys, us, you know, being the three of us talking right now. But there's almost never them and us in a more meta sense, if you pay any attention at all. So I was asked to come on a poetry tour to Jordan, traveled with Trevino Brings Plenty and some other people, Jen Fox Bennett, a number of really great native poets, Lance Henson. And
when was this?
2005.
The recent past.
The recent past. And there were a couple of people who'd been asked to go on the trip, said no because they were afraid of what might happen. The recent fraught past.
Yeah.
And I just kind of went, well, you know what? I'm curious and I want to go. And so I went and it was glorious. People were fabulous. We had a great time.
And you're still here.
Yeah, I managed to come back. Shock of shocks. Although my luggage does get searched more often with the trip to Jordan on my passport.
Well, a camel you rode during that trip turned out to be a big part of your journey and a central character in one of your poems. Can you tell us about the camel?
I didn't ride that camel.
Oh, that was a different camel.
That was a different camel. The white camel was tethered. We went to go talk to some Bedouin people. In my memory, I think they were related to one of the men that we met when we were in Amman. And the white camel was pregnant and tethered down. And it was right near you talk about Lawrence of Arabia. It was right near one of the major events in the Lawrence of Arabia story, near the Seven Pillars of Wisdom. And they gave us popcorn and sage tea, and we sat there and visited. It was pretty amazing, actually. And listening to the camel, who was talking a lot. So
that's not the same as the camel you rode, because in some of your introductory remarks to your collection of poems in this book, you also talk about riding a camel and that was sort of one of your favorite vantage points.
It was. I'd never ridden a camel before. I've ridden horses, donkeys, other four-footed things. And I'm used to mounting up myself, but it's pretty high, and I'm not very tall. So I remember really having to fling myself up into that saddle and having everybody kind of look at me like I was crazy because I'd gone to all that trouble to get into the saddle, and there were people waiting to give me a foot up. So there was that. But then when the camel gets up, they lurch forward and they lurch backwards to get up, and that was a bit of a shock to me as well. But they're amazing animals, and not anywhere near as grumpy as the ones that I'd met in the U.S.
Talk to me, though, about the significance of animals in your poems and in maybe the way you saw this part of the world, because we also have wild orange kittens and lizards and fish.
You know, it's an interesting thing because I spend a lot of time around people who are not native as well as around people who are. And folks are often saying, how come you notice all the birds? How come you notice it? Because they're there. And, you know, we're all sort of here. I figure they're neighbors and you have to pay attention. I'm a huge biology geek as well. So I guess that's part of it. But I feel like I can learn things by watching what the animals are doing, as you know, on top of that.
What did you learn from the orange kittens?
The orange kitten was very skeptical about human beings, but, you know, semi-feral, but ended up being okay with it because, you know, we can all be in here together even if we don't entirely know what everybody's motivations are. Just have to kind of keep an ear up.
In one of the poems, the one with the pregnant camel, in fact, there's this image of sand as sugar. And I remember reading that and feeling like there was something hopeful about that image and also something a little bit sad, maybe overly hopeful, and maybe that's what's sad.
Yeah. One of the people we were traveling with, it's the finest sand. It's incredibly fine. I don't know, the life of those people is a life of contrast, just as it is for Native people. In those moments, we were just, it was perfect, you know? Each of those moments was perfect. And overall, their lives are really under attack right now, the Bedouin. But we did have some conversations about being taken away to school and that sort of thing.
You mean taken away from communities and in order to be educated?
Absolutely, in much the same way that folks went to boarding schools here. You know, so I think one of the things that we had to offer our hosts was an insight into the how boarding school experiences eventually shake out if you're not real careful.
You know, I want to read just a small portion of one of your poems and ask you a question about it. You write, We each take a cup of tea down the Roman road to the treasury, to the tombs lit with candles. There's more music, more chairs for the invisible God. He must be busy. Does it matter how much we witness? Now, that question at the end there is an important one. Does it matter to bear witness?
Yeah, does it?
Yeah, good question.
I'm sort of asking the reader. I have my own answers. I think it does. I think part of the responsibility of being human beings, in a John Trudell sense of the word, human beings, is to witness for one another, to make sure we see what's happening, and to try to have some empathy as well as to what that means to those people that we're witnessing for, not just in our own decoding of the symbolism, you know? So.
What do you think about that, Linda? I mean, that sort of... the big question I think this book asks in a lot of ways, and I think each poet maybe brings a different answer, if not question, to it.
Well, I think that's really what this book is about. It's a witnessing. It's a witnessing of these people as people, not as Middle Easterners, not as Muslims, not as potential terrorists, but as people like other people, living their lives, loving the land, loving their families. And so it's an act of witness.
Kim, before we go, I want to ask you about another line from your poetry. I know you say there's maybe a risk in seeing this too much through our own little codes, but this does seem a little bit coded, and I'd like to ask you about it. You write...
Sure.
I stare at the embroidery for too long, shapes familiar, shapes my fingers have made, fall in love with rose water and honey. Can you unpack that?
Sure. I mean, there are metaphors, of course, but I'm a textile artist as well. And one thing that you find out, especially in this world where we talk about cultural appropriation, on a micro scale, you find that human hands and minds and aesthetic will come to similar conclusions no matter where you are, you know?
There are things that people seem to gravitate toward and find beautiful?
Yes. I think there really are ultimately things that we can agree upon at that level.
Things, you know? Like embroidery, rose water, and honey?
Rose water and honey. I'm afraid I became quite affectionate about Middle Eastern pastry when I was in Jordan, and that taste just sticks with me. But yeah, embroidery and you know, sweet things.
Poet Kim Shuck, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
And Linda Rodriguez, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Linda is one of the editors of The World is One Place, Native American Poets Visit the Middle East, published here in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman, and there's more Central Standard right around the corner here on KCUR. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Enrique Chi and Juan Carlos Chorand. They're musicians with the band Making Movies, and their new album, I Am Another You, is making a big splash. In fact, they just found out it's hit number 18 on the Latin pop Billboard chart. Enrique, Juan Carlos, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
How do you find out something like that?
Well, our manager, he understands that game a little better than we do. And so you have to submit what you've been selling on the road and to Billboard. And if I guess they notified him. They're like, yeah, you will be on the chart. And then they're also a business. So you either pay for a subscription to subscribe to the Billboard charts, or you pay a service for them to send you the chart.
So, because that's crazy. I looked it up and it shows you on the chart for a date that it's not here yet.
Right. It's July 1st. It's actually, because that's when they issue, because the print issue comes out a week later. But these are all systems that were created long before the internet. So the chart had to exist and then be put into print. And then the next week, the magazine would hit the newsstands be sent to the industry. But that's kind of antiquated because we have the internet now, so we can know instantly what's happening.
So you are number 18 in the future right now.
We're number 18 in the future right now.
All right. Yeah.
For people who don't know your sound, it may be in some ways what they might think of as Latin pop, but in other ways, not at all. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, I think we don't consider it really Latin pop by any means. I mean, I think...
Or even Latin music.
Or even, yeah.
Not exactly.
No, not really. I think what we try to influence is, the rhythms of Latin America and things like that, but we don't... It's not necessarily should be categorized as that, but I mean, we'll take it if it's on the if it's on the Billboard, it's okay. But it's more like I was saying, we just try to influence a lot of those African, Western African rhythms and ancient rhythms into what we're trying to do. I guess is our way of playing rock and roll music. So I think that's kind of our take of how to simplify the way our music is. Our genre, but I mean, it's a lot more than just Latin pop rock, I guess.
Yeah, the to me, it's the same attitude as rock and roll. Like if you look back at a Rolling Stones album, which that would be like the birth of what we now consider rock and roll, like a couple steps removed from Chuck Berry and Elvis. Rolling Stones would put a country tune on their album. Their best approximation at a blues song. Their best approximation at an American folk song. And they'd synthesize all that on an album, and they're clumsy, not exactly right versions of what a country song should sound like or what an old black blues song should sound like is what rock and roll is. And for us, like, we are just mixing up a slightly different stew of influences, and we put that in our best mistakes of trying to sound... Well, we're trying to sound really folkloric right here. We're never going to be that way. We're not 80-year-old men from... Veracruz, Mexico. So when I do that rhythm, I'm not going to swing it just right, and that creates our music. So to me, it's like it's the same attitude and spirit as rock and roll.
I feel like in some way what you're talking about is a very nuanced way of seeing authenticity. Like a lot of people think of authenticity as in if a person is Latino, that person can authentically make Latino music. Whereas it sounds like you're talking about that a real person living in the United States today is influenced really by a lot of things.
Yeah, that's I think exactly right. And authenticity is a great word. And for us, people ask like, what made you decide to make this kind of music, or what made you decide to make this kind of concept album or whatever? It's like, we're just kind of talking about our families. We're not really, I don't know how we would make any other kind of music.
What is the story of the new album and how does it intersect with the story of your family?
So the album talks about three characters, three young men and kind of who are experiencing some level of diaspora or like some level of conflict in their lives. And these are three like very tangible people. Like my cousin shows up as a spoken word performer on the album, and he's in the narrative of the album and talking about his experience of leaving Venezuela through the political turmoil is a very tangible thing that we all experience. And he actually traveled with the band for a few years. Or a few years ago, he spent some time with us. And so the band felt like close to him, like a brother. And then a couple other friends who are at this kind of same age group, young men, but they don't know each other, completely different environments. And I guess I just started to feel, we all started to feel the link between their experiences. Like, you can't really measure, like, what is more painful or what is more joyful for the human experience. And the album came out of trying to figure out a way to express this feeling that you get when you meet all kinds of human beings. That's kind of one of the beauties of being an artist, is that you do get to do that. And you realize, wow, there's so much different, and that yet there's these core things, these core needs and desires that are so similar. And that's really the point.
We're going to hear some music in a second, but Juan Carlos, is there a character in this album, the three characters whose stories are kind of told, whose story speaks to you in some way?
I think the one that I was closest to is actually a friend of mine. And he went through a really rough time, and luckily right now we still keep in touch, and thankfully, you know, he's been able to get out of his rut and everything that was going on in his life. He's the closest one to me, but I said, his cousin, you know, we got really close to him, to where we, you know, he became a cousin to me, you know. And so his story and everything that he had to go through with Venezuela and everything like that, it was pretty, it was intense to hear. And now to see him, that he's in Panama, he's doing well, he's going to school, finishing up school, he's been a doctor.
Yeah.
It's good to see that something good has come out of this.
What did your friend's rut have in common with that?
Just the fact that they both were going through, well, as he was escaping a country, my friend was kind of escaping his own personal demons.
What kind of personal demons?
It had to do a lot more with drugs. Anything that had to do with drugs that he was involved with, whether it be using or and abusing or selling. So it was tough to see him go through that.
Let's hear a song from that album. We're going to be hearing Enrique's voice on that album. We're also going to be hearing someone else, a singer named Elena Moore. Anything you want to tell us about her before we hear this song?
Yeah, so Elena, we were just talking about her in the car. She's our dear friend of mine from Denver, Colorado. She sings in a wonderful band called Tennis, and she sings the background vocal on this song. So she sings a little like doo-woppy sounding thing. It actually came up really organically. My brother and I were like, we need something to fill up this chorus. Why don't we sing something like Elena would sing? And we laid it down, and we're like, why don't we ask her to sing that? And then she did, and it was awesome. And then the other singer that sings the lead vocal is from a band called Hooray for the Riff Raff.
Okay, this is Brave Enough by Making Movies, featuring Hooray for the Riff Raff and Elena Moore. There's a really summery vibe in this song.
We're hoping for
it. It doesn't sound like a song that's from the story of people, you know, struggling through adversity, which is so much of what you just talked about. Am I misunderstanding what it means to struggle through adversity? I thought I knew.
No, I think this song is specifically when, like, this is when the party's still fun. You know, like the party hasn't soured yet, and the living the high life and on, you know, no pun intended, is still pleasurable, right? The decadence is fun. And I think that anybody who goes down that path is, you enter it because it's fun, I think.
What does I Am Another You mean? That's the name of your album, and curious about that.
It comes from a Mayan phrase, in Lakesh Alakin. Which was kind of like a greeting for the Mayans. It's a way that they, you know, if I ran into Juan Carlos in the street, I'd be like, in Lakesh, and he'd say, Alakin, back. Like, hey, what's up? How you doing? But it means, I'm another you, and you're another me. And I think that that's super cool to think that these ancient people were already kind of thinking of the human experience in that way. Like, we're connected somehow.
But that's how you greet someone?
That's how you greet. That's how you say hello.
What does it mean to you, Juan Carlos?
Oh, that's exactly. I mean, I believe that greeting should be held to everyone's standards today. I think being greeted that way might change his perspective easily to somebody who doesn't know a complete stranger, because in some form, just the human experience, I you never know what somebody else is going through, no matter what, who it is, where they are in the country. So I think we should bring that back.
Yeah.
This album, like your previous ones, was produced by Steve Berlin of Los Lobos. And his mentorship, in a way, has played a huge role in the evolution of your band making movies. So for listeners who don't know that story, would you mind giving us sort of, I don't know, the short version?
The short version was, we met him about, 6 years ago? I think we had opened up a show for them here in Kansas City at Knuckleheads. And we had, I don't know how many songs he saw of us, but at the end of the show, he happened to go up to Enrique and spoke to Enrique about how much he really enjoyed the show, and that he had thought that there was music playing overhead. He didn't realize it was a band playing, so he had to come out from behind the stage to kind of see that we were playing. And at that time, we were about to go in to start recording a new album, and he had asked Enrique, and he was like, you guys need a producer, call me first. And sure enough, he was the first one that we had called.
We didn't have anybody else to call.
Yeah, exactly.
He didn't know that.
But that's what I love about this story. And that's what I think a lot of people love about this story, is just that you weren't in some position where Steve Berlin taking you under his wing was this inevitable next step. Like, what was going on in your lives at that moment?
Well, my brother had just rejoined the band, which was exciting. But we didn't know how permanent that was. Our touring vehicle had just blown up, and we didn't have we didn't really have any momentum. I mean, we had thought some things were going to go really great. We'd gotten some opportunities to play bigger shows in Chicago, but nothing was really culminating into any kind of momentum. So it was just like, it was just super magical. Like, we were finishing up this tour with the other artist that sings on that track, Hooray for the Riff Raff. We spent 3 weeks with her, and we had a day off in Vail, Colorado, right at the end of the tour, and we called Steve, and we're just like laughing with him. We're like, "Man, we don't know what you heard 6 years ago, but I think we understand now how to make music, and you had some vision, and you knew how to kind of trick us into being ourselves."
Kind of like being on the future pop charts.
Yeah,
right,
kind of like being in the future, yeah.
We've got to take a break, but when we come back, we'll hear about the music camp these guys have started for Kansas City kids at the Matty Rhodes Center on the West Side. I'm Gina Kaufman with the band Making Movies, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking with a couple of musicians from the band Making Movies. They're a rock band that sings in Spanish and English, and their new album, I Am Another You, has just reached number 18 on the Latin pop Billboard chart. Vocalist Enrique Chi, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Hello again, keyboardist Juan Carlos Chiron.
Hello.
You guys have a music camp for kids, which sounds fun. Can you tell our listeners about what you're doing, where you're doing it, who you're meeting?
Yeah. 6 years ago, it really started with conversations that Juan Carlos and I had as we met organizations in other cities that were doing inner city stuff for Latino kids or for the immigrant neighborhoods in their community. And so this is now, it's the sixth year that we're hosting a music camp out of the Matty Rhodes Center in the historic Northeast. It's August 1st through 5th. And I believe all of their like flyer and marketing materials are up on their website, mattyrhodes.org. But basically, we wanted to provide, and at first we didn't know how to do this, so we just kind of winged it, but we wanted to provide the kind of level of a music camp that would just be awesome, you know, and more authentic than the school of rock stuff that exists. That stuff can get it's kind of a money grab and can get a little cheesy. But we wanted to provide that with no real, barrier of entry financially, and we wanted to place it in a neighborhood that needs help. And Matty Rhodes Center has an amazing facility right in the heart of the historic Northeast, in the rough part of it, like down by Topping and St. John, where there's I think there's like a halfway house pretty close there, and it's pretty rough right around there. And so we wanted to be someplace that kids could walk to, that didn't, there was nothing stopping them from showing up. You know, it was like, I don't have a ride, or I can't afford it, or that kind of thing.
This makes me wonder just about your own story of, I mean, did you guys get into music as kids, and how did that happen?
I didn't get into music till I was a little bit, like, in my teenage years. I mean, I was always around music. My mother has a folkloric dance group here in Kansas City that she started 35 years ago called El Ballet Folklórico Atotonilco, and I've been dancing since I was 3 years old. So being involved in the community has always been a part of my life. And so I think that when this idea popped up, when Enrique had talked about it with the music, we're like, well, of course, we need to do something. And, you know, luckily through our connections that we've had with working with other, like, foundations and things like that, we decided that with Matty Road Center, it would be a great idea to do it. And
I'm sort of amazed that you grew up dancing but not making music. I mean, was dancing a way that you learned musicality?
I think so. I think for me, I was always around it. My dad was a musician, and so it was easy for me to get it. He was a drummer. So I think that, you know, was easy for me to kind of just be involved in music.
For those who don't know what Ballet Folklórico is, one of the biggest parts of it is this tap dance work, where they have these boots with nails put in them so that they hit on the wood boards. And it has a beautiful history of kind of dark beauty. The Spanish took away the Africans' drums. And so, but flamenco dancing and Spanish dancing has some footwork. So in order to keep those rhythms alive, they transported it into the footwork. So he has been playing drums with his feet since he was teeny tiny, because it's literally the rhythm of the song is sometimes footwork. Our new album has a song, Montaña, where the percussive track is Juan Carlos' feet.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So he's been, I guess, in a way, you've been playing drums your whole life.
I guess so. I never thought of it that way, but yeah, I guess so.
Enrique, how did you get into music?
My dad, you know. I've never had a formal music lesson, and so it was really my dad just teaching me how to play the guitar. As a little kid, I just couldn't wait for him to get home to show him what I'd learned and have him show me something else. And I'm very lucky in that regard. That's actually part of the inspiration for the camp, is like, if you don't have a dad that has that talent, we wouldn't have been able to afford like a $500 music camp. Never in my childhood would I be able to afford something like that. So that made us desire like to fill that void, to maybe light the spark for some young person to want to perform.
Do you think that never having had formal music lessons shapes the way you teach formal music lessons?
Yes, it does. Because I think that there's some things that that I've learned through music in a weird intuitive way, and I try to chase that for the students. I try to find two things. It's like you chase what makes them passionate about music, and you figure out, okay, so what is really drawing this kid to want to do this? And so if you can show them how what they have to do, because there's things you just have to do to get good at music.
Like practice,
yeah. And there's some monotonous work involved. If you can show them, look, this monotonous work leads to your end goal.
Which is to rock
usually, yeah, but there's different goals. You know, some kids like want to write, some kids want to perform, some kids want to record, some kids just want to sound just like some song they've heard. So you go, look, to get to that song, sorry, you gotta practice these bar chords, good luck, you know?
I hear there's some big news to share about this camp.
What would be the big news? We've decided to expand upon it. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah, that is big news. All right.
For a second, I was like, wait.
You got it.
Yeah, so 5-6 years of doing it through the Matty Road Center, we've decided to start our own nonprofit. Today I have the first meeting with our board of directors, and we have some really talented people that are helping us. Because through this camp, and this kind of segues into what we're going to talk about, that I would meet some of these kids that could write really well. There's this young student, Regina, who, when we met her, she was 13, and she had these beautiful songs coming out of her mind, and she didn't know how to make them into music, but she had all the pieces there. And we've just encountered a lot of students like that. So tonight, for this other event at the Folly Theater, two songwriting students are performing their own original works. And I realized there's not a lot of programming for those kind of young people. That's kind of those kids who find music as like a lifeline and they pour their souls into it. There's no program for them. So we're creating a songwriting program and we're going to bring in some heavy hitters. Steve Berlin has already verbally committed that, like, once you got the program up and running, I'll show up and teach the kids. And like the singer of the Get Up Kids, who's a band who's internationally famous, he's like, yep, I'll be a guest teacher. So
cool. We'll be following that.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Before we go, I want to play a little more music from your new album. This song is called Spinning Out, and it sounds a lot different from the song we heard earlier. Let's give it a listen. Spinning Out by Making Movies. So talk to me about, you know, like this song does, I think, have a really different sound from the other one. Can you talk about the difference? Because I don't really have the language for it.
Yeah.
Neither do we.
I don't know. I think that there's a more aggressive tone to this song and there's more bite to it. And the other... Brave Enough is the only song in the album. The other one we heard that is tongue in cheek. It's meant to be a little bit sarcastic in its whole attitude, and the whole rest of the record has this more melodramatic mood. And so, you know, from a rhythm standpoint, we thought that the tongue in cheekiness fit like a boogaloo cha cha, like '60s, you know, mm-hmm. New York Latin thing. So that's what Brave Enough has, and this is a very Afrocentric, it's like a rumba clave bell pattern, but we have this kind of alternative song living on top of that very Afro rhythm.
You know, and Juan Carlos, is there anything else you want to say about the rhythm in particular?
Yeah, I think, when it comes to, you know, creating the song for us, now it's me and my brother. Prior to it, it was me and our last drummer, Brendan. It would be more of just our creative juices, just figuring out how we can make the song different from the last rhythmically wise. And Dicker would come in with the song, with the structure of his idea of what he thinks should be. And, I would have him play it. And then I think rhythmically, you know, we would kind of hash it out, thinking, oh, well, does this sound more like a rumba? You know, does this sound more like a cha-cha? Or does this sound... It just depends. We mess with different rhythms and see which one fits the best.
A lot of people might look at your situation with your band Making Movies as though, like, you've made it now as musicians. And we had an actor on recently who was talking to us about the myth of making it. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious whether you feel like you've made it, and if so, what that means.
I think it is a myth. It's a journey. The entire process is a journey, and we had a really magical moment where Juan Carlos plays on Hooray for the Riff Raff's beautiful new album. She's getting all the accolades you could ask for. Rolling Stone said top 50, you know, she's like top 10 new albums of the year and all this stuff. And that her album was actually influenced by meeting us. And so we're playing the Fillmore. We open up the show. Juan Carlos plays on her set, and then we all come collaborate on the last song. And that is a moment of triumphant moment of making it. And landing on the Billboard chart is also triumphant. But at the same time, this is a time where an artist like us needs the most support, because we now have everything on the line on this business sustaining our livelihood. And so in a lot of ways, 5 years ago, it was a lot less risks and we didn't need the support the way that we do now. So this is the
time.
Like
if you had screwed up before, it wouldn't have been visible to anyone.
It wouldn't have been visible, and it wouldn't have impacted my ability to pay rent and keep a roof over my head, and now it does. So I think that this is an important time for Kansas City to step up and really support an artist.
Well, Enrique Chi, Juan Carlos Charon, thanks for joining us from your band Making Movies, and congratulations on on your success, but not making it, because that's a myth.
Yeah, the
Thank
journey.
You very much.
Thank you so much.
Their new album is I Am Another You. They're performing tonight at the Folly Theater in a benefit for KKFI, and July 27th at the Record Bar. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope. Danielle Hogarty is our intern. Thanks to Ron Yerman for making us sound great. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend, everyone.